Happy Shabbat, everyone. Happy Sukkah. It's my pleasure to be with you this evening. We have the full cast of characters today, even though he is a bit in pieces still. We have James back with us. Hello, JB.
How's it going?
Good. Boy, it's really great to hear your voice. I understand your leg is on the mend. You can put most of your weight on it, and soon we'll be able to...
50% so far.
Okay.
You're doing pretty well.
They tell me I can do more.
Okay, and when do you think you'll be able to go back to work?
Hoping as soon as I can get to walking, ideally. Because while I'm in the chair, they still want me elevating my leg, which is kind of hard to do if I'm walking around or moving around a lot at work. So.
Okay.
I heard that the scoreboard over there.
The shoulder really hurts, so.
Yeah, I'll bet it does. I heard the school board over there have instituted the new 100-yard dash rule, you know, that you got to at least be able to do that in 9.5. How you doing on that?
I heard that one.
Well, the Rascals fully charged. You can probably do it without much difficulty.
Oh, yeah. I do got one
on your motorcycle, I'm sure.
Well, you have a motorized chair, right?
Yeah, I got a little motorized wheelchair a friend of the family gave us, so... Use that.
And you got that up pretty quick.
And Patty is well on her way to delivering a daughter.
Yes, we found out Monday we're having a little daughter. We're excited.
Oh, wow. Wonderful. I just left my granddaughter. I left my wife there. But we had dinner with them. This was their second day at home and our first day with them at home. It was really... being with them at the hospital at the delivery day was nice, but being with them at home and just that whole experience of adding a new member to the family is pretty wonderful. Kirk, you were with me today as we received a phone call where we put a gentleman on hold. We didn't cut him off. I put him on hold. I only put him on hold after he made a statement twice that was incorrect. And as is my custom, I always want to correct something before we move on. And when I went back to this individual, he had hung up. And he immediately posted something fairly nasty on the Facebook site for the show. And then wrote me a uncomplimentary email. And I want to turn to it because I think it is important to air these things out. Is that all right with everybody?
Certainly.
Sounds like a good place to start.
Okay. For those who didn't listen to the Shattering Myths show, a gentleman named Wayne from Texas called in and he wanted to talk about the timing of the mikra, which always scares me because most people that want to talk about the timing have a perspective that is that a month is not a month and that you don't have a solar lunar calendar and that you've got the Shabbat beginning with the first day of the month or some other the lunar Shabbat thing and I just go
Hey guys, just real quick, Elise is telling me we've got a really bad echo. Does anybody have like a speaker on or anything like that? Or?
No, I don't hear anything.
Yeah, I don't know if really. I'm talking with the same headset I normally use. So I'm hoping it's not me. Let me read you the anyway. He called and wanted to say, you're incorrect in your assessment of the timing of these things and the rendering of Kadash as month. Then he said it twice. He just says, no, that's not what it says.
And oh, really?
Yahweh uses the word Kodesh, and the word Kodesh speaks of a month. It is specifically the renewing light on the moon's surface is the term. Its verbal root is Kadash, and Kadash means to renew. So, he's pretty... explicit. There's the first month and the seventh month is when we celebrate these days and these Moed Mikra. He says, no, that's not what it says. Now, I'm more than open to somebody saying, you've translated the word incorrectly. Have you considered the following? Or maybe there's a different way to interpret that. Yes, I understand that's what it says, but there's another statement that might lead to a different interpretation that is still consistent with the other statement. I'm all ears, but Larry, since Kirk's already been part of this conversation, where does Yahweh begin discussing the Mikra?
He really starts. Well, I mean, he begins discussing it in Bereshit.
Well, that's only the Moed. He mentions that the sun and the moon are there for us to establish the timing of these meetings. So he starts it related to the Moed and
Genesis
with the sun and the greater and lesser light, specifically
right.
to talk about the Moed, which tells me that we're dealing with a solar year, the greater light, but we're going to run our calendar based upon the lesser light, the moon. So it's a solar lunar calendar, which was the timepiece for 99% of the ancient world because it's the thing that worked the best. That's what that says to me. Now, could I be interpreting that wrong?
Yeah,
possibly, but that's certainly the most
No, I don't believe that. I think you're dead on there. I've looked at it good and hard, especially when he lays down the fact that in that fourth day, that greater light's going to become visible, and he's talking about great symbols and signs. And by the way, there's one thing I want to throw in while you're doing this. He taught us how to do that vis-a-vis the moon. There was no moon festival part of it. It was just how to count the days. And they didn't line up with all Satan's sun worship things and all this nonsense. They were separate and apart for that very reason, by the way. And when he really gets into the Shabbat, he's talking about 7, and he didn't have to give special instructions for the Hebrews or the Hebrit to count to 7. They could do that. They could count to seven.
Yeah, they could. Not much of a difficulty. So here's the email that was written to me, and it says, "Craig, as usual, no one is allowed to question or debate Craig Wynn. Since I was cut off the show today, I will explain my reason for calling. The word Kodesh means head of the month, renewal, set apart. It does not mean moon, which is the Hebrew Yeresh. Nowhere in Scripture are we given instructions to formulate a lunar calendar. Judah adopted the lunar calendar of Babylon after exile." He goes on, but you get that.
Thanks, genius.
Okay, now, first of all, I am a flawed individual. I am impatient. I have a tendency to know where, I guess maybe it's because I was in sales so much in my life, but I almost always know where somebody is going and whether or not where they're going is going to be useful or not useful. Now, this email the guy sends is pages long. So for him to have presented his argument for a different calendar, it would have taken hours worth of shows, and I don't think anybody that was listening would be interested in it. And I made that conclusion very early on, but I also made the conclusion that if you're going to say something that is incorrect, I am going to correct that before we move on. Kodesh was properly translated in the sentence that I referred to. This is the sentence. And Yahweh spoke to Moshe for the purpose of saying, converse, speak words with the children of Israel on the 15th day of the 7th month, Kodesh, time of renewal, is the festival feast of shelters for 7 days in proximity to and in association with Yahweh. My translation of Kodesh is what it says. It means month or time of renewal. So, while he is correct.
And by the way, we can go right back to Pesach and we find the same thing. Except now we're in the first month.
Okay. I'm not much of a fan of a red herring. I did not say that Kodesh was the Hebrew word for month. While Yeresh is the Hebrew word for moon. While Yeresh is the Hebrew word for moon, it's used very sparingly in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. And when it is used, it is never used in association with the Moed Mikre. So if we're dealing with timing of the Moed Mikre, we should not use Yeresh. We should not translate Kodesh as moon, but we should recognize that all of the numbered months, and especially the first month and the seventh month, are only designated using Kodesh, not Yeresh.
Yeah, and he did say back there in Bereshith, didn't he, that it was the greater and the lesser light that were great signs and symbols.
Yes,
wow. So this lesser light, what is this? Is
well,
it
let me talk about what... Now, I'm not going to claim that the lexicons and dictionaries are always right. But what I will say is that if you think they're wrong, you better have a really good reason for saying they're wrong. And if they all agree, then maybe... And that agreement is consistent with the most logical translation of the statement, then you're really going to be hard-pressed to make an argument against it. Theological workload of the Old Testament. The meaning of Kodesh, month, monthly, new moon, used in a sense of to repair or rebuild. Although this word properly means new moon, it is commonly used as an equivalent to our word month. So it is month by extension, new moon by definition. Because the month begins when the thin crescent of the new moon was first visible at sunset. It is used along with the more rare Yara from Yareh, meaning moon. Note, especially in 1 Kings 6:1, 37, 38, and 8:2, where the terms are used interchangeably. Now, if they're used interchangeably, you can't begin your argument by using a red herring. I did not say that Kodesh was the Hebrew word for moon. I said it's the Hebrew term for new moon or renewing light on the moon, and by extrapolation, month. What I said is 100% accurate and consistent with Yahweh's testimony and with every lexicon on this. And then he says, although the terms are used interchangeably in 1 Kings 6:1, which means you don't have an argument, Wayne.
Although
Yara is never used as a numbered month. Doesn't Yahweh refer to the first and the seventh month? Aren't those numbers 1 and 7?
Mm-hmm.
So he's only referring to those using Kodesh and not Yara. If you're going to make an argument on Yara, you're inconsistent with Yahweh's testimony. By the way,
I see. So I own seven dogs, and one of them's yellow. But
yeah.
I never, you know, this is
yeah, I, and I said that the word dog means a canine. You know, the Hebrew,
doesn't
word,
mean
the Hebrew word for yellow is yellow. Okay. Now, Kirk, when was the Torah written approximately?
3,500 years ago or more. That would be
1450 BCE, right around then.
Yeah.
When was
the
exile in Babylon?
Oh, that was
some years later, folks.
Yeah, it was a couple hundred years.
You're talking about 2,000 years difference.
Yeah.
Is what
about 1,000. The exile in Babylon.
Oh, 1,000. About 500 BCE. So,
yeah, okay. 500, 600 BCE is the time they were having all the conflicts with the Babylonians.
Thank
500, 600 BCE. Torah revealed in 1450 BCE. So how is Yahweh's testimony here about the timing of the, in his own words, the timing of the Mikre influenced by the Babylonian captivity?
Couldn't happen.
No, correct.
We're talking about 1,000 years difference.
Why do they, you know, here's my question to you.
Why would you make an argument? Now, is it true that Yahudah and Yisrael, but mostly Yahudah at this point, adopted Babylonian calendar practices? Now,
yes.
Partially true, but irrelevant to this discussion.
totally.
It's partially true only. And that, you know what kind of a calendar the Babylonians used? And I'm asking Kirk just because Kirk likes his
It was. I know when I was studying Daniel, they had to use the Persian calendar.
They used the lunar moon, didn't they?
The answer is lunar solar. They came up with a specific formula that that was identical to the one that was used by the Hebrews, where you have a certain number, every certain number of years, you add an intercalendar month, and what you end up with on that formula is a 365 and a quarter day solar year using the lunar calendar.
Which is brilliant.
And it's what the Babylonians used. And so the Babylonian calendar could not have corrupted the Hebrew calendar because they were the same calendar. Now, there are a couple of differences, but the differences are not in the way of using the moon to keep track of time and then correlating that by adding an intercalendary month to make the lunar year equal to the solar year. The difference were the Babylonians started their year in the fall as opposed to starting their year in the spring. And second, the Babylonians named their months as opposed to numbering their months. But, you know, there are a bunch of books in the that we consider inspired in the Tanakh that are part of the prophets that use those names. Now, if they use those names, it can't be anathema to God, because he inspired those prophets.
That's right.
And those Babylonian names find their way into the... Because it's just like if I say that Yosha is going to return at sundown on October 2nd, 2333, it's a Monday.
Mm-hmm.
I am not celebrating the fact that it's a moon day. I'm not acknowledging the fact that Oct is no longer the 10th month of the 8th month of the year because they added two men's names as if they were God to push it further out. I'm not claiming that it is the 8th month of the year. It's the 7th month of the year. I'm using a nomenclature that can convey important information.
You're being in the
you know, I'm
community.
Telling you that October 2nd in 2033 CE is an important date because it coincides with Yahweh's
year 6000.
His date, yeah. Year 6000, Yom Kippurim, sundown, start of Yom Kippurim, and year 6000. And if you want to know what that relates to on your calendar, that's what the date is. That is
and, of course, that's not a moon day.
The Babylonian names. All right.
Yes, it is a moon day. Yes,
okay, so let's go on a little further. The Hebrew calendar used a lunar month fitted into a solar year, as did the Babylonians. This was done by adding an extra month approximately once every 3 years because it was about 11 days less than the solar year. In early Israel, the first month of each year, and I'm reading this from the theological workbook of the Old Testament, that in early Israel, the first month each year, or new moon, was determined by observation and proclaimed officially by the blowing of trumpets. The moon was considered to be, the month, excuse me, was considered to be 30 days. Note, Genesis 7:11. Also 8:3-4, unless the new moon was observed earlier. Now, that's going to happen every other month, right? The moon phase is 29.5 days. If you're assuming that the month is 30 days, every other month it's going to be 1 day shorter. Yeah, one day shorter every other month. Yep. For only four of the names of the months used in Israel's earlier history are recorded in what they call the Old Testament, the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. Abib, the first month, makes its appearance in Shemot Exodus 13:4. And it becomes there in 13:4 because it's telling us the timing of the first Passover. So it defines the first Passover. The second month is presented in Kings 6:1. Ethnim, the seventh month in Kings, 1 Kings 8:2. And Bull, the eighth month in 1 Kings 6:38. Most often, the months were simply designated by number. Note especially in 1 Chronicles 27, 1 through 15, where all 12 months are listed by number. Wow, geez. 12. All listed by number. But you're telling me that Yahweh doesn't have a lunar solar calendar? Later, the Babylonians incorporated names were incorporated into the Hebrew. Of these, seven are used in the so-called Old Testament. Nisan, the first month, and Nehemiah 2:1. Seven, the third, and Esther 8:9. Elul, the sixth, and Nehemiah 6:15. Kislev, the ninth, and Zechariah 7:1. Tebeth, the tenth, and Esther 2:16. Shebet, the 11th, and Zechariah 1:7. And Adar, the 12th, and Esther 3:7. So that's my point. This idea that, the basis of his argument here is negated by the fact that these names are included in the prophets. And you've got to be really careful when you go out on a limb with an unusual interpretation that what you're saying is the basis for it isn't undermined. The first month, Abib, began in the spring with the vernal equinox. This was instructed in Exodus 12:2 and 12:18. That's exactly what we said today, wasn't it, Kirk? That Yahweh established the time of the first month by referring to the barley as the Abib and the flour of the flocks.
You agree?
Yeah. In Shemot, Exodus 12:2 and 12:18, he defines the first month. From that point, all you have to do is count.
Yeah, and you get to 5 months. I understand why it was such what he was complaining about. To be honest with you.
Yeah.
Well, that was my next question to you guys. What wild tangent is this guy on?
I didn't read it five different ways.
There's no way out of this.
No.
There's no way out of it.
Defines Kodesh as the new moon. The first day of the month, the lunar month. They say that it's from the verb kadash, which translates as renew seven times, repair three times, to be renewed or repaired, to renew, to make anew. The New American Standard Bible Dictionary says that kadash or kadosh in the noun form means month or new moon. The Dictionary of Biblical Languages says that it's month, calendar, lunar, month, a period of time of one full cycle of the moon. It means to renew, to restore, to place in a state or condition identical or nearly the same as a prior state, to renew oneself, to reaffirm, to confirm a prior relationship or association. You know, when I make a big deal of the fact that most Hebrew nouns are defined by the verb, by the action part
that's
of
important.
The word.
That's important.
I think it's unbelievably important, and I don't know of any place where it's as important as it is here, where you look at the verb, and the verb says reaffirm, confirm a prior relationship or association. Isn't that?
Yeah.
Yahweh's using a term that defines the purpose of these things.
Restoration. Yeah.
Right. Affirmation. Restoration. Renewal.
By the way, I think Strong should say new, because that's what they put in their words.
Strong's, and on all of these, when they say new moon, they know. In fact, Strong's, when they define the verbal root, goes right to renewal. And so Strong's know that it means renewed moon, renewal.
Yeah, I'm kind of poking at them because they make obvious mistakes.
They know it. But the reason that you see new as opposed to renewed is because the religion requires it. The religion requires it. It requires, even though they don't, they fully admit that Kadash means renewed and restored, they have to have a new. And so they say it means new moon. But then they will all say, a new moon is not what we call a new moon. What we call a new moon scientifically is a dark moon. It means no light on the moon's surface. That's what we call a new moon. that's not what Scripture calls a new moon as defined by Kadesh. It's the renewing of the light on the moon's surface. And every one of these lexicons acknowledges that. It's when the first sliver of the moon is seen before sunset.
I'm looking at the ancient Hebrew lexicon, and I'm also looking at the Hebrew Chaldee lexicon, and they say that exactly.
Yes.
And, you know, they say, you know, it's renew. Yep. Make something like new through repair, restoration, or it can be something that is new, or it is the first crescent of the moon as a renewal of the moon on the first day of the moon.
But I'm back to the same question you had, Kirk. What's this guy's point? What does it mean? I mean, I'd make him define it.
I mean, I don't think
the point was, I think it took a whole lot to do. It didn't take any discussion. I mean, it's pretty straightforward.
Yahweh's testimony in Shemot, timing the beginning of the year in the first month of Abib, is extraordinarily clear, not difficult to translate, simple, straightforward. His use of Kodesh to define the first month and the seventh month, straightforward, irrefutable, everybody agrees. It means new moon in the sense of the first sliver of a crescent on the moon's surface, and that it is clear from Genesis that Yahweh has a lunar solar calendar.
He says it right there. That's where they were made, for great signs and symbols. Right there.
Right. For the Moed, so for the meetings. For the meetings.
Yeah, and it says Moed. It doesn't say to count to seven either.
So, concise Hebrew and Aramaic lexicon, new moon. The day on which the crescent moon is again visible. The day after the new moon. The Genesis.
Well,
Hebrew
what story had he
lexicon.
Made up?
The
is
new
he
moon.
Doing the full moon now?
The day of the new moon. The calends of a lunar month. Difficult dictionary. New moon, month, lunar month, beginning of the new moon. Hebrew Aramaic lexicon, new moon, the day on which the crescent appears.
Yeah.
Well,
you're not on social media, so you don't see some of this idiocy. I had one that I read, it must have been several months back, maybe 6 months ago, where the actual feasts, you start counting on a full moon.
Yeah, then why would
you just
use
make
a,
your stuff up?
A word that's based on renewal, and why does every lexicon disagree? Now, is it possible that every lexicon is wrong?
Backwards.
Yeah, I guess it's possible. Is it possible that the verb renew is wrong? No. The verb kadash, meaning to renew, I have looked at every time it's used throughout the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, every time that it's used. Because I wanted to know if it could be translated new or if it was better to be translated renewed and reaffirmed. And what I found is there are a couple of instances where new or renewed were equally good, and there were 3/4 or maybe even 80 to 85% of the times where new was not correct and renewed or reaffirmed.
So
I
got
looked at every single one of them.
Would you rather camp out?
Single instance that renewed.
Yeah, camp out in the darkness or with the reflected light of the moon.
You know, I mean, yeah. Some of these things are very strange.
If you're going to walk during the night and you do not have any lights and you're trying to get out of Egypt and you're going to lead your people out of Egypt, you're going to lead them out with the light of a full moon or in the darkness of the night with a new moon.
Right.
There's a reason that Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim are with the maximum lunar intensity, and that so is Sukkah when you're camping out with Yahweh.
Yeah, these are pretty important. You know, I had a woman I come across my homepage there the other day with the fear of God is the beginning of knowledge. She at least didn't say Lord, which I said, so you're going to take a word like Yira that can mean fear or respect, and you're going to go with the low road. And I put Jeremiah right up there. You know, that's one of my favorite passages.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, it blows religion out of the water. That's what I realized. You know,
Tradition,
you know, yeah. Yeah, and I And I said, so what you're saying to me is that although Yahweh says, you know, all fear of me is taught by rote in man's traditions, and it's not true, you're disagreeing with him here. And she pulled up Strong's right away. Yerah, fear.
Right.
I said, now let's not be a horse's ass, because it can go both ways. And I put it up again. I said, so are you saying that Yahweh's saying that all respect of him is a man-made notion learned by rote? Two of them jumped in. You may have knowledge, but you walk in the wrong spirit. I said, no. You walk in the spirit of Strong's, which was there to reinforce the KJV goddess book, sun goddess book, and I'm showing you Yahweh's words in extant form, DSS, nothing older, no way, and you're siding with men over him. Now, what spirit do you walk in? Well, I got booted, of course, blocked from that point.
I assume here that what happened is that this fella was influenced by one of those people who has a special insight. There's the lunar Shabbat people, and they are really big on the lunar Shabbat, man. And nothing matters. And if you don't agree with them, and you're a heathen.
They read Jubilee, and they read the Book of Enoch. These guys.
Now I am here to tell you that, in fact, James, you and I have been down this road so many times. My answer is always the same. I am not an expert. I will never say that I'm an authority on dating Yahweh's Mikra. And people will always challenge me when I say that by saying, but you don't think that God wants us to celebrate on the exact day? You're saying that God's not exacting? No, I'm saying that he did not provide us with a means to be exacting. He provided us with a means to be very close. He provided us with all the information we need to think about it, but he doesn't give us the answer. Now, you can say...
He wants you to think about it. That's why.
That's my conclusion. And what but I've got another conclusion. Not only does he want you to think about it, he doesn't want you to be dogmatic.
Yeah.
If I could be the answer man, and every time somebody asks when is Pesach, and I gave them it is so and so and so and so a day on our calendar, then who's going to bother to think about it? Who's going to investigate Kodesh and Kadash and first month and two sevens and why it begins at sunset and ends at sunset to facilitate Yosha both having the Pesach dinner and being the Pesach lamb? Who's going to think about the fact that the eyewitness accounts show that it occurred on the days of the week that Daniel predicted and allows matzah to fall on a natural Shabbat? If you don't think it through, if you're not trying to investigate it to learn, aren't you just going to miss all of that?
Well, isn't it great fun to discover it?
Right.
Well, it isn't just that. It goes beyond that. You know, I mean, if somebody wants to really attack you based on that, exacting, numbers and timings and things like that, aren't you the guy that really brought the Yobel to the front? I've never seen a Yobel discussion. You talk about timing. I mean, what are they talking about here?
I've never seen anybody come up with the timing of his return based upon the Yobel, based upon the Daniel's prophecy of precisely when he fulfilled the prophecy of walking into Jerusalem to be cut off, but not for himself, and doing the extrapolation based upon the Yobel all the way back to Noah and getting booted from the garden to the return on the garden and what that means on our calendar. It all fits perfectly.
I'm going to tell you, it burns me up when I see attacks like that because they're cheap. All you're saying is, I'm not the know-it-all. That's it.
That's right.
Think for yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Think for yourself.
It's the Monty Python life of pride. We can think for ourselves.
Hey, did they ever hear of this one? Did they ever hear of this one? We all eat our own bread alone on matzah. Did you ever think of that?
No.
Well,
I will tell you that Jamie, you and I have a disagreement, and we've spent a lot of time talking about it, on the timing of Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim. And and in each of those, we have engaged in it because you've taken the time to translate the words and you've considered all the references to it, as have I, taking the time to translate the text and looked at all the references to it. And you did not begin by stating that we're one day different because
you're just wrong.
That my translation was wrong. Now, if you had and you had said, this is why I think your translation is wrong, I've been all ears. But you just say, you didn't begin by saying it doesn't say that. You began by saying, yes, I can see how you get to where you are, but I think there's another way to look at this which is equally valid. Now, if Wayne here from Texas had said that, I would have listened. But if you begin by saying, no, it doesn't say that, and I read in the passage, and that's exactly what it says, and if your argument is that Kodesh doesn't mean moon, but I didn't say it meant moon, I said it meant renewal of the light on the moon, you don't have an argument.
No, you don't. Oh,
that's your complete straw man.
Right. And if you're saying that the ancient Hebrews, as in the Torah observant Hebrews, observed the Babylonian calendar, you'd be wrong. If you say that the lunar solar year was a product of Babylon and not a product of the Torah, you'd be wrong. This couldn't be any more direct. I'm not going to call it simple because you do have to think it through. You've got to take the time and you've got to process the information. But, you know, here's the first reference. In the first month, Kodesh, time of renewal, on the 14th, now this is in, Kara called out Leviticus 23:5. He's introducing Pesach Passover. And, you know, if I'm going to come up with the timing of Pesach Passover, where would you go I think there's only two places you can go to establish the timing of the Pesach Passover. One is where he first introduces Pesach Passover during the Exodus,
mm-hmm.
Where he talks about it being a beef. And the second is when he's presenting the Moed Mikre in the heart of Kara, Leviticus 23. So here he is. On the first month, on the 14th of the month, this is Kodesh, Kodesh. For the purpose of understanding and making a connection, at twilight. So we know that the day is starting at sunset, is Pesach, according to Yahweh. You can't render it any other way than month, time of renewal of the light reflected on the moon. And then here is it from Shemot, Exodus 12, 1 and 2. In addition, Yahweh spoke to Moshe and to Aaron in the realm of the crucible of Egypt for the purpose of saying, this month shall be your first and foremost time of renewal, Kodesh. It shall be for you and on your behalf the first Rishon. Kodesh, month of the year.
We're on here again. Yes, I do. Kodesh does not mean moon. This is somebody in, this is Wayne, I guess.
So.
It's possible to have the head of the month without it being lunar. Well, Wayne, that would make Yahweh a liar,
yeah.
Because he said that the moon and the sun would combine over in Bereshit, if you want to take a look at that, to create great signs and symbols.
Well, then it would mean that the entirety of the Hebrew experience and Daniel's prophecies, all wrong.
I have to tell you that you've just stood the Torah on its head.
Yeah.
And we're not
Why?
People that follow religious tradition over here.
So there isn't a culture, there isn't a testament anywhere that has month, defined by anything other than the moon. The moon was the means to tell time.
Yeah, you know, English is based, obviously, on the alphabet, or alphabet. And we call the moon, moon, let's see, we do month.
Moon month. Yeah, look at every Hebrew. So you want to have a definition of Kodesh that is estranged from moon, but the primary definition, according to every Hebrew lexicon, is new moon.
Yeah, so, you know, Wayne, just go ahead and type in your response. What does Kodesh mean? What does it mean, if not renewing of the light? He didn't say it means Yarish. We know what Yarish means. All of us do here. We know what Shemesh means and Yarish means and all that.
That's what I'm curious. What is he saying that Kodesh means then?
Yeah.
I put a stop to it right here. I want you to define Kodesh. Not seeing anything, being tired. I'm worried over here.
Yeah, well, you know, I've spent more time on it than I care to.
There's something I do want to bring up when as soon as you're finished with this.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm done.
I once asked you. I never understood the plan. I never really understood the plan. I understand what it represents. I understand the foreshadowings. I understand the fulfillments. But I always thought, why in the world did Yahweh decide to take a beating in the form of Yahusha, rather, his consciousness? I called the number. Can I speak? He says. I'd like to see you beat him up. Really?
No, I
would love it. Personally, I love these battles.
I tell you what though, I am not going to subject myself to the aggravation. Since he's got a long text to justify his position, I will. I'll send his argument to Richard, who will post it. My guess is Richard will post it. I'll send it to you, Larry. You can post it. And you all can debate it as long as you want to. And JB, you got some free time, and you like this kind of stuff. You spent a lot of time trying to research the Shabbat thing, that the lunar Shabbat deal. And so I'll send it to you. I'll forward it to all of you. And then you can
respond. My response might take a while, as I'm limited to one-handed typing, but...
Yeah, okay.
I want to go back to this.
I do care what Yahweh has to say, so let's read a little bit more about the timing of Pesach. He says, speak to the entire witnessing community of the children of Yisrael to say, on the 10th of this month, on the 10th of this Kodesh month, according to each individual, accordingly, each individual shall obtain on their behalf a male lamb for himself and for his home, a lamb according to their father's household. Carefully observe and thoroughly consider the Pesach of Yahweh, your God, engaging in and acting upon it in association with the Kodesh month of Aviv, time of year, right, when the grain of barley plant is in the ear, yet still soft, green, and moist. Because in the Kodesh month of Aviv, Yahweh your God brought you out from the crucible of Egypt during the night. Boy, that tells you everything you need to know, I think. First month of the year is tells you when you do it, and the noun Kodesh is written identically to the verbal form Kedash, which means renewal. And he's bringing you out of the crucible of Egypt during the night. So don't you think maybe that the full moon on the 14th day of the month would be an accident? God wouldn't have you walking, stumbling around in the darkness?
I love it because when I go outside at night on Passover, you know, when I'm here with my lamb, nice bright moon. So we sit outside sometimes for it, and it's a great time, and you know, nice bright moon to see. Sitting outside under a new moon, it's kind of hard to do anything unless you've got artificial light.
You and I are on the same page with this. So on the first and foremost day, he's talking about the festival feast of Sukkah. There is a set-apart invitation to be called out and meet Mikra. Now, Mikra is a word just like Kodesh. If you want to understand Kodesh, go to the verbal root. You don't have to go very far. It's spelled exactly the same way, so the noun and the verb are listed right next to each other in Hebrew. And there is not a single Hebrew scholar or lexicon that doesn't make the connection between Kodesh, the verbal actionable form, and the noun, since they're written identically. So we're dealing with a renewal. And there is one, and only one, celestial object that whose light renews. And it is an ideal timepiece for people to know when to do things. So perfectly suited for the purpose. He says, you shall not engage in any of the work of the heavenly messenger. So the teaching here is about the feminine manifestation of Yahweh's life. But the point I was going to make is that when you're dealing with words, like, for example, Mikra, the best way to define Mikra is to look at the verbal root. Yahweh tells us in this discussion on Sukkah that Mikra is based upon Kara. And Kara means to call out, to welcome, to invite, to summon, to read, to recite, to meet, and to counter. Encounter. So if you're trying to define Mikra, when Yahweh says that it's based on Kara, how are you going to define it?
Same thing.
Aren't you just going to say that it conveys all of the actionable aspects of the verbal root?
Right.
So why would you treat Kodesh any differently?
You wouldn't.
Well, I wouldn't. But,
you know. No, I wouldn't. Not if you're trying to understand. So.
Not if you're a rational thinking individual.
No. In fact, then you look at the next sentence here when it says, do not engage in any of the work of the heavenly messenger, Malacha. There isn't a single Hebrew lexicon that I have looked at that doesn't tell you that Malacha is from Malach. And in Hebrew, the way to transform a noun from masculine to feminine is to add a hey at the end of it. Ben becomes Bena for son to daughter. Ish becomes Isha from male individual to female individual. Ish, as in male manifestation of light, becomes Isha, feminine manifestation of light. The technique is consistent all the way through the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. So if I wanted to define Malacha versus Malach, wouldn't I look at how all Hebrew words go from masculine to feminine with the addition of the hey at the end and apply that consistent analysis?
There's no argument there. Hurting thing.
Seems like the logical thing to do. And the same thing is with Isha. With Isha, you've got fire, but feminine. Or you have mother. Or you have female individual. Or you have all of those things. I rather like all of those things. The feminine manifestation.
Well, if there's five options and they all fit, they were all intended.
That's my view. That's my view as well. For 7 days, approach and come near, Karab. The material manifestation of the light, Isha, unto Yahweh. On the eighth day, there exists a set apart, Kodesh. Invitation to meet, Mikra, on your behalf, for you to approach lot. And you should answer and respond to the invitation and present yourself before Harab, the adoptive mother who purifies, enlightens, and elevates Isha, to approach Yahweh. The words make sense. I just like the plain reading of the words. Now, is there other interpretations that you could derive from these words? Sure. But why would you not start with the plain meaning of the words and then talk about the symbolism that's intended? You know, like fire. Fire purifies. Fire cooks food so it's more nourishing. In fact, the things that aren't healthful and food are eliminated with cooking.
Lights up the darkness
so you can be more observant. Yeah, scares away the beasties. Mm-hmm. Keeps you warm on a cold night. Keeps you from stumbling and falling. The heat of the fire not only warms you, but it rises up to the heaven. There are a lot of symbolisms of fire, which is why Yahweh used the symbol of a pillar of fire and the fiery light on the top of the mountain to represent himself during the Exodus and during the revelation of the Torah. So now he is encouraging us to come into the feminine manifestation of this same light, which is the set-apart spirit. Her joyous assembly of people, Asherah, feminine, from Ashar, but the feminine, a festive celebration of partygoers, but her, do not engage in Ashar, any of the work, Obadah, of the feminine manifestation of the messenger, Malacca. These godly and specific, and we're talking about Sukkah, we're celebrating Sukkah still, these godly and specific appointed and designated meeting times. So God says they're specific, they're designated by him. He does not say their date is certain. He did not give us a means to date them for certain. And we've talked about this. I think he did it for a reason. You've got, no matter who you are or where you're coming down on this, since these are his instructions on the Moed Mikre, there is nowhere here in this discussion that he tells you that the definition will be, since it's based on renewal, a visible renewal, and you have to observe it, because that would be silly, because you could be 3 days into the month or a week into the month and still not have observed it if you're during a rainy spell. You know, the East Coast has been deluged with rain. They could be a week into a new month and not be able to observe it. And if you lived in a place where you did not have access to the western sky, you would not be able to observe it.
There's a real problem in Alaska.
Right. Real problems in Alaska. And also, are you talking about somebody with 20 vision, 2010 vision, 2040 vision? What is the vantage point? You know, when it's first introduced, they weren't in Jerusalem, so you can't say the vantage point is the Temple Mount, because they weren't there. And it's for all people in all places and all times that these dates are to be celebrated. So you're not everybody standing there on the Temple Mount, so you can't say it's just on the Temple Mount. So God gave us a means to understand that he wants us to meet with him 7 times a year, 3 times in the first month. The second time is 7/7 later, and the third time is a reflection of the Yovel, and the third time which is really the 5th, 6th, and 7th, but the third separate designation of these times is during the 7th month. So these godly and specific appointed and designated times, Moed, of Yahweh, which relationally you are invited to attend accordingly, as set apart Mikre. Now, so he is calling these 7 meetings Mikre, from the verb kara, invitations to be called out, to greet, to encounter one another, for reading and reciting. For the purpose of law, coming near and approaching the Isha. adoptive mother who enlightens and elevates a gift which elevates, a reconciling sacrifice, and also a pouring out of the word, a day for his day. That's the purpose of this. The pouring out of the word of Yahweh. That's the only place you can go to get a definition is the word of Yahweh. Now, if you want to talk about the covenant, I'd go to Bar Rishit. The only place the covenant is fully disclosed. If you want to go to the Mikre, you're going to go to the 23rd chapter of Kara to understand the timing and the purpose of the Mikre. If you want to understand the Yobel, you're going to go to the 25th chapter of Kara Leviticus. You know, if you want to understand creation, go to the opening chapters of Bereshit. If you want to understand the Exodus, there's a book devoted to it. That's where God is providing us the information that we need to make these decisions. And it is all from His Word, part of a pouring out of His Word, a gift to us, which elevates. As part of the Shabbat of Yahweh, as part of your contribution to the relationship, as part of all of your vows and promises, as part of your expression of your freedom to choose relationally, give yourself to Yahweh. Is there a better conclusion anywhere? This is really the conclusion of his, although he'll talk a little more about Sukkah. But isn't this a beautiful conclusion to the Mikre? He's talking about the Mikre as a whole. He uses the term plural as opposed to singular. So he's talking about the Mikre or whole or a gift from Yahweh, which elevates us, where he made a reconciling sacrifice, where he pours out his word for this day, his day. And then he says that the Mikre are equivalent to the Shabbat. It's a plan of 6 + 1 = 7. And then he tells us that as part of your contribution to the relationship, he wants us to engage. You know, we went through the Mikre. There's not a single day and among the seven where we don't have to do something. We're not saving ourselves. No, we're engaging the relationship. That's, I think, the confusing word for so many people who are religious, is that they say, you know, salvation is the gift of God, as you know, your Pauline doctrine. But the fact of the matter is, God's not about the business of trying to save us. He's about the business of trying to reconcile the relationship with us so we can be part of His family. He then wants to save His children.
When you say the relationship is the deal, and then that's the byproduct of that is the salvation.
Correct. And relationships, which is the deal, cannot happen without both parties being engaged.
Mm-hmm.
Effort. Yep. What you will find out soon, JB, is that while you made a contribution initially to the conception of your daughter, your wife is going to play a much bigger role.
Oh, yeah. She's already playing a much bigger role.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but you still made a contribution. Without your contribution, it doesn't work. And as you go forward, in her first year, Patty is going to play a much bigger role. And the nurturing of your daughter in the first years. But for her to be able to do that, you're going to have to make a very sizable contribution.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it is. Yahweh and our spiritual mother do far more for us than we do for them. But we have to engage. Otherwise, it doesn't work. And so relationships require you to engage. And so Yahweh is saying, as part of your contribution to the relationship, that which you give for the good of the relationship, as part of all of your vows and promises, if you want to be part of the covenant, you have to agree to be part of the covenant. That's your promise. I'm going to do those five things. When you answer the invitation,
you have to understand it. You can't agree.
Right.
He doesn't want you agreeing to it until you understand it.
Yeah. Because you're really not agreeing to it.
Effort.
Correct. and it requires you being willing to meet with him on these 7 days and understand the plan of seven, what it means to us as part of your contribution to the relationship, as part of all of your promises, as part of your expression of your freedom to choose, your free will. Relationally and beneficially, deliver yourself, dedicate yourself, entrust yourself, give yourself, Nathan, to Yahweh. And that is certainly what we attempt to do. I think there's only one way to do that. Personally, now, I'm open to suggestion here, fellas, but I think there's only one way to give yourself to Yahweh. I think that to do that, you have to first get to know who he is.
Mm-hmm.
You then need to understand what he's offering. You then need to come to respect him for offering it and for who he is, and come to trust him to deliver what he's going to, what he has promised, and accept it. And once you've accepted it and you engage in accept his invitation to meet with him on these days, and you become serious about listening to what he has to say, then you have put yourself in the position of giving yourself to him, of entrusting yourself to him. And well, Nathan can mean, and the primary meaning of Nathan is to give. That is the primary meaning. I actually think in this context, Nathan can mean place yourself before, or it can mean entrust yourself to. I personally think that entrust yourself to is a really good definition. I think place yourself before is a really good definition. But you know what I also like? Give yourself as a gift to Yahweh.
Yeah. Well, that's the gift he wanted.
That's the gift he wants. That's the gift that gives him the most in return. Yes, the gift that he wants. That may be that statement from Leviticus 23:38 may be one of my very favorites. Then he says, indeed, on the 15th day of the 7th Kodesh month, when you have harvested in your field from the land, you should celebrate the festival feast of Yahweh for 7 days. With the first and foremost day, there shall be a Shabbaton for resting and reflecting, and on the 8th day, a Shabbaton. So he's equating each of these three times, the combination, the Pesach, Matzah, and Makorim, which I see as one, as a collective whole. I think that anyone without the other two is somewhere between useless and counterproductive. What's the purpose of being perfect if you've got no place to go with it? What's the purpose of being perfect if you're not immortal? What's the purpose of being immortal if you're still flawed? What's the purpose of being adopted if you can't come into Yahweh's presence? Why would you want to be adopted into Yahweh's presence if you're flawed and he's perfect and he knows that you're flawed? You know that you're flawed.
And if
wouldn't you feel awful? Wouldn't you be like Adam trying to run away from him and hide if you know you're flawed and you know that he knows you're flawed? So I view those as one. I view, Shavua does two things, but it does those things at a separate time. But he's very clear that the first three represent a harvest. They are the harvest, the barley is being harvested. And then you have the early harvest, the early summer harvest of grains that is part of Shavua. But Teruah, Kippurim, and Sukkah are also a collective, and they are a harvest, an ingathering. And I think that the first fruit harvest here is actually Teruah in this particular discussion. But he's talking about the fall harvest.
Sure,
the seventh month. He's talking about the fall harvest, with the first month beginning in the spring. the seventh month is the fall harvest. If the first month begins right around the spring equinox, the seventh month is the time of the harvest.
Seven. Wow.
And if you take on the solar calendar, 7, 29.5 day periods, lunar cycles, and you add that to the vernal equinox, which is when barley is a beef, you are going to be at the fall harvest. So indeed,
right.
On the 15th day of the seventh month, when you have harvested your yield from the land.
Yeah, and if anybody's been around a farm, you'll find out that's how it works, too.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah, you know, I just was at my son's home, and my son's wife's sister married that fellow in Pennsylvania that I spoke of in the past that has a large apple orchard. Guess what he's doing right now?
Harvesting.
He's finishing up his harvest.
Yes.
What
his wife
now.
Was here to celebrate the birth of his of her sister's baby daughter, but he's not here because he's busy doing harvesting. Yeah, this is the time that one harvests. When you have harvested from your yield of the land, you should celebrate. Celebrate. Chag. A festival feast, Chag, of Yahweh, for 7 days. With the first and foremost day, there shall be a Shabbaton, a day for resting and reflecting, and on the eighth day, a Shabbaton, to rest and reflect and think about an eternity with Yahweh, camping out with Him for all time. And you should grasp hold of, on the first and foremost day, the fruit of the tree, the glorious adornment of the frond of the palm, the branch of the leafy shade of the leafy shade trees, and the river willow shoots. So he's got this menu of things here. Things he wants you to grasp hold of, to receive, to obtain, to acquire. Things that are going to be symbols to help understand what this is all about. So, what are they? The first thing that he says is the wooden timber, the fruit of the tree. You know, the fruit of the tree, the fruit of the upright pole is Yosha's sacrifice on Pesach, where he stood up for us so we could stand with him. That is the fruit of the tree. You know, you have the fruit that was good for Adam and Chala in the garden, nurturing, beneficial. You had the tree of the the tree of life, right? So there's a tree of life, and so first day, take from the fruit of the tree. And the fruit of the tree is designated as Passover, which is the tree of life. The fruit of that tree is the tree of life. The glorious adornment of the fronds, of the shoots and branches. In this particular case, it's because it's a glorious adornment, it's majestic, honored, splendorous embellishment and beautification of the fronds. The shoots are branches of the palm. Well, the palm, and you have to think, all right, I'm trying to understand this in using the lexicon of the day. Do you know what they use palm fronds for, first and foremost?
Sure. It's covering from the sun, from the rain.
Right.
I mean, of course.
Right. Yeah. That's what the roofs were made out of. In fact, in primitive cultures, it's still the case. If you have palm fronds, I don't know if any of you watch these survivor shows, but if there's palm fronds available, the first thing that they'll cut down to make the roof of their shelter, palm fronds. It is a natural material to make shelter. And so that's what he's suggesting. It's also interesting to me that the fruit of the palm, the coconut, is filled with milk, the kind of thing that nurtures us. Again, you know, if you're in one of these survival situations, what's the tree you most want to find?
Coconut tree.
Coconut. You know, electrolytes, fluids, you know, a milky liquid.
I drink coconut milk every day. I know what it is. It's good for you, too.
Yeah, there's very few people that are very conscious of their health that don't drink coconut milk. I do as well. In fact, you got me into it, Larry, and I've ever since I was on my my diet, I drink coconut milk.
It works, you know, and it's also positive pH, by the way, as opposed to acidic like cow's milk.
Yeah.
So it's very good.
When we think of paradise, you know, you think of paradise. Maybe we all have a little different views, but when I think of paradise, the pictures that come to my mind is a tropical beach scene. You know, where the water is warm and it's that turquoise crystal blue, and the beach sands are white, and you've got the beautiful palms. You know, it's a sign of paradise.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sign of protection. It's a sign of living in the most beautiful of all places. So that's the palm frond, and the shoots are a messianic term, of course, an offshoot, the set-apart spirit, and the most set-apart, the Mashiach, of the palm branch. And the palm branch, by the way, was used. It was called, it was on Branch Monday, not on Palm Sunday, but on Branch Monday, when the Mashiach came into Jerusalem to be cut off, but not for itself, where they called him out, the one who comes in the name of Yah. Of the palm branch, of the leafy shade trees, and the river willow shoots. The leafy shade trees, you know, same concept. Yahweh wants us to rest in the shade. He wants to provide a covering, a protection for us. But, and the trees grow as they, you know, that which grows and is natural is of interest. But the willow shoots. Do you know somebody that is equated with willow shoots?
Yeah, that'd be Yahosha. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, Yahosha. How about Moshe?
Yeah, Moshe too. Yeah.
Aren't we told that Moshe was drawn out of the willow shoot?
Oh yeah, out of the river.
Yeah.
Right.
Specifically,
yeah.
That he floated down the river in a basket made of willow shoots. And he was plucked among the reeds, the willow shoots, along the side of the Nile. Isn't that all correct? So if you are going to the river and you're pulling a river shoot, who are you going to think about?
Okay, you're going to think about being pulled out of the land of Mithraim, you know, I mean, drawn out.
And what did Moshe do? He worked with Yahweh to draw his people out of the crucible of human oppression and to the freedom of the promised land, and in the process delivered the guidebook for all of us to make that same journey called the Torah. So when I see river willow shoots, I'm thinking, well, let's focus on Moshe, the one drawn out of the willow shoots along the Nile, who was part of leading us from human enslavement and human institutions to the freedom of the promised land, and who gave us the Torah as a guidebook, as instructions along the way.
Hey, let me ask you a quick question. It's a grammar question. Nahal, the symbol of the spirit, Ruach Kodesh, yet it's a masculine noun, and the Araba is a symbol of the Masayah, and it's a feminine noun. Mm-hmm. Is that just a function of grammar somehow that seems like it should be reversed?
Yeah, you think so, but the...
is it just because the river becomes male?
The ish here is the sh, so it is a masculine wooden timber, which makes sense.
Okay.
It's the center pole of the tabernacle, and it's the upright pole that the most set apart masculine hung, and that the Passover lamb was masculine. It was always a masculine male lamb that was there, so the ish should be male. So I think that's the reason for it being masculine.
Okay.
So, you know, here we have a beautiful set of symbols, all of which that help us understand what it's going to be like to camp out with God and how we get there, and bring them all together, and you have a beautiful visual picture. And he likes the terms, these agriculture terms, by fruit of a tree, too, because on the Sermon on the Mount, didn't Yahusha go over and over again about the only good things come from good trees? And, yeah, only bad things come from bad trees. So you can't get bad fruit from a good tree, and you can't get good fruit from a bad tree. This tree is the Torah. This tree is Yahweh's tree of life. It provides this good fruit, and it provides our adornment and our protection and our means to enter paradise, all provided by the one who gave us the Torah and who led us out from the enslavement of human institutions. So then Yahweh is not done. He says, rejoice and be glad. Be happy. Express your joy. In the presence of Yahweh, your God, for 7 days. Celebrate it as a festival feast in association with Yahweh. 7 days during the month? No. Year. So we just used the concept of month, but month in the concept of a year. So 7 days during the year, rejoice and be glad in the presence of Yahweh, your God. For 7 days, celebrate as a festival feast and to approach Yahweh. 7 days during the year.
You know how the King James does that?
Yeah.
By contrast, is a solemn day of rest, period. What a crappy translation.
Yeah. Shama means express joy, be merry, party, flourish, take pleasure in, enjoy, celebrate. Shama. And Pene means presence. I mean, face or presence.
Face to face.
Rejoice and be glad in the presence, Pene. Of Yahweh, Yahweh means Yahweh, your Elohim, your Almighty, for 7 days, celebrating it as a chag, as a party, festival feast, as a really good time, in association with Yahweh, 7 days during the year. It is a clearly communicated prescription of what you should do. Shuka means to engrave. Hey, I learned something today. Maybe I'm stretching here, but what's the Hebrew word for Yahweh cut the covenant? Cut.
Karat.
Karat. Karat. With the Hebrew with the K, right? Karat.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And the sign of the covenant is to cut the foreskin, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we all know that on the eighth day, our blood coagulation is an all-time optimum level. Do you know what vitamin it is that is not present in a newborn on the second, third, or third day, but comes in and it becomes extraordinarily prevalent in at the eighth day? Do you know what the name of that? Because most vitamins have a letter designation. Vitamin K.
How cool.
How cool is that? Yeah, we've got the company with the K and it's vitamin K.
That's good.
Yeah, I learned that from my elders. She's not circumcised, obviously, but they were asking my son if he wanted his daughter to be given a vitamin K shot, because until she reaches around the eighth day, her blood will not coagulate well enough, so she was cut. She would just continue to bleed, and at newborn and through day two, she has no K. And so they said, you want the vitamin K shot? It's just fascinating, isn't it? K and Karat. I'm sure that's just a coincidence. So chuka means to engrave, to cut into stone. It's an engraved invitation that is is cut into stone of an inheritance eternally. This is a clearly communicated prescription, olam, forever, in your door, homes and generations, no matter where you are, dwelling places and incumbents. So this is the point that I just don't get the Christian avoidance. This is a clearly communicated prescription of what you should do no matter where you are. When you live, for all time, along, for eternity. So how could it have been done away with by somebody who walked out of the pages of the Torah, who said that nothing in the Torah is going to be annulled?
Eternity is a very short period of time, apparently.
Apparently. And Yosha's testimony, obviously, was errant. But you can trust him when he says other things, but you can't trust him when he says, do not think that I came to do away with the Torah. Not a single letter that comprises the Torah shall be annulled so long as the heavens and earth exist. But what this says, now this, that had a caveat that not a single jot or tittle of the Torah shall be done away with so long as the heavens and earth exist. The heavens and earth exist are not going to exist forever. Sukkah will exist forever.
Mm-hmm.
That means, folks, that we're going to be celebrating Sukkah long past the year 7,000 Yom. Even after the heavens and earth are gone, we are still going to be celebrating Sukkah because Sukkah is not limited to 1,000 years.
Well, if you want to pick one, that's a good one to celebrate forever. Celebrate by dancing and singing and a happy feast.
Telling jokes, laughing, having a good time.
You know
what child also means? You know what it means?
Exactly.
It's form a circle for dancing, but the other one is to hug, to embrace.
You know, and I'm here to tell you, JB, that your hugging arm and your dancing leg are not going to be impaired during eternity.
Thank you. I wish they'd get unimpaired sooner than that.
What if it turns out that his dead-like, zombie-like body is what gets risen?
Yeah,
it would be wrong. You know
I had a really long exercise session yesterday and slept on a pillow and woke up with a very stiff neck today. Ooh. I can't see how having a stiff neck and pain so that I have to turn by rotating my whole body would be an asset in eternity.
You don't. Even when you're moving at the speed of light, where it might fall apart and stuff like that.
Fall apart, blow up. I'm really happy that I'm going to be enveloped in that feminine manifestation of Yahweh's light for all eternity. And I understand the correlation between light and eternity. And the only way that we could celebrate something for eternity is for us to cease being material. Because if we're material, we can't exist for all eternity, but we can if we're spiritual energy.
Wait a minute, you're throwing way too much science in here, man. Let's get back to it.
Okay, I'm sorry. Okay.
Zombies,
but clearly dead
bodies,
it's something that's engraved, that cuts us into the relationship eternally. In your homes and in your generations, dwelling places and sheltered encampments, no matter when or where you live, celebrate it in the seventh month. You shall live in shelters for 7 days. Sukkah. So he's telling you that Sukkah is based upon living in shelters, living in a temporary sheltered covering for protection, a Sukkah.
Okay.
You shall camp out.
You know what I discovered? I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt. Do you know what I discovered talking to William this week? Is when we were talking about Sukkah, and Sukkah is the shelter where you're moving out. The whole of eternity is moving. You know, it's not a stationary type of thing. It just kind of dawned on me that we're extremely actively engaged in stuff in Sukkah.
Thank goodness, because if this said, you know, you're going to do, it just said, no matter where you are, this is an eternal prescription, an everlasting prescription. And then he says you're going to live in shelters, in tents.
Which are temporary
places. Clothes.
Not a permanent place.
For 7 days. So that means we're going to be camping out with Yahweh for all eternity. Is there any other way to interpret that?
No.
Nope. Why would he juxtapose those thoughts if he's not telling us that heaven and eternity is about camping out with him for all eternity? It's my idea of heaven too. I really like the idea. I want to be active. All native-born Israelites shall dwell in sheltered tents, so that your households and generations will know. Yada. Will be aware of, will understand the physical symbolism of me having the children of Israel live in covered shelters when I brought them out of the land of the crucible of Egypt. So he is equating this journey to Sukkah to the Exodus. And the doorway to the Exodus was Pesach. And the threshold that they crossed in route that first day, that next day, was matzah, so that they could be adopted as his perfect and eternal children, so that they were empowered and enriched with the revelation of the Torah seven sevens later, ultimately becoming Yahweh's prophets, his troubadours, commemorated by Teruah, reconciled in a relationship with him so that they could camp out with him. And you know what's interesting is he's talking about this camping out in the wilderness during the Exodus en route to the promised land, which he's telling us that the camping out is the intended part. It's the journey, not the destination.
Yeah.
Eternity is going to be about the never-ending journey. A never-ending journey of discovery. A never-ending time of camping out and exploring and having fun around campfires with Yahweh.
Now, that's cool.
That's cool. But that's what he said here. And you're right. It's all active. Everything that we're doing in eternity is active.
We're not sitting on a cloud playing a harp for all eternity?
No.
We'll travel.
There are times where, in fact, even during these times where Half Tent will travel, we will be singing and we will be dancing and there will be music. And we're going to listen to Doge strum whatever musical instrument that he liked to play the most. We're going to listen to it. It's going to be fun. We're going to see Yahweh enjoy the music. We're going to enjoy the music. Yes, we will be doing some singing. We'll be celebrating these parties for all eternity. And during this party, we'll be camping out someplace together. I think it's the time, by the way, we all come together to share what the experiences that we've had. Because sharing the experiences is what makes them so wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a huge part of the joy.
Yeah, I think so, too. Well, I'd like to conclude our program today by, first of all, thanking Yahweh for the opportunity to camp out with him and for this marvelous path that he has provided away from the crucible of human religious and political oppression to the freedom of being with him. And just reemphasize the notion that, well, I do not have any appreciation for someone who says that's not what it says, when it's clearly that's what it says. I am all ears if somebody can say, you know, I can prove that all of the lexicon's definitions of these words are inaccurate. From the verbal root of the word, from Yahweh's use of the word. But if you're going to undermine Yahweh's testimony by saying that's not what it says, and then you're going to throw in red herrings, which is what happened today, Wayne, I am not going to be a patient listener. And so if your conclusion is that I am a flawed, irascible, impatient guy, that's all true. I did not have any interest in listening to what you had to say. I do have interest in listening to what Howard has to say.
You know, he told me that I'm such a tanker, some such nonsense in here. I would throw his ass out of the chat room, him and his four Yeshua, Mr. Yeshua guy, because Mr. Yeshua doesn't even care what Yahweh says in his words. I'm going to tell you why. I put up a passage for Mr. Yeshua, who's in here pushing the book of Henoch because he's a retard. And this guy actually,
Tell us what you really
mean. No, I mean, this guy's a low-life prick, okay? That's all. Yahweh says that he's awesome on the account of the presence of my name. That would be Yahusha. It wouldn't be Yeshua. And isn't Yeshua really a corruption of Yasha?
So you're telling me that Wayne's pal is a Yeshua person.
He's going to differentiate
between Yahweh's name and Yahusha's name. That's not a good start, but that shows rabbinic influence. And
that's what he's into, that the
basis of their argument requires for them to make their argument, they have to quote the book that is obviously a fraud, Enoch.
Yeah, why was it written under a pseudonym? Everybody clearly states this is written under a pseudonym.
Why was it written during the time that Yahweh told us that he tried to find someone to work with but couldn't find anyone? It was written around 300 BCE. So it was during the time Yahweh said, I looked but I couldn't find anyone.
So it's in direct opposition to his
words. But I'm not surprised that the justification for this is that, as a matter of fact, you've got here Jubilees 636 showing up in the proof statement from Wayne. Anyway, I'll send this to you guys. You guys can deal with it if you want to. I'm not a fan of Jubilees.
Isn't that about the 4th century or something?
Yeah, I don't know when Jubilees was.
Jubilees.
Yeah. If you're going to base something on Jubilees, I'm not interested. If you're going to base something on Enoch, I'm not interested. If you're going to base something on the Torah, that's fine, but the Torah is pretty clear in Kara, the 23rd chapter, in presenting these dates.
Hey, JB, doesn't it say, JB, that in Dabarim, that in order for a book to be true, you know, like the one here where the donkeys are having pink elephants and, I mean, very fanciful, wild stuff, as in the Book of Enoch, I couldn't even believe what I was seeing there. Doesn't it say it has to have verifiable prophecy in it?
Yep, that's what
Yahweh
said.
It came
all
by one.
If there's a giraffe and all
from Big Wayno in Texas, is the only instructions given in Scripture to formulate a calendar of any kind are found in the chapters 72 to 82 of the Book of Enoch. Enoch's not Scripture. Enoch is a complete and utter fraud. And it is.
Yep.
If you don't know that Enoch's a fraud, then don't be embarrassing yourself.
I mean, where's the prophecy?
If your basis is Enoch and then Jubilee, no, I don't want to listen to you. I have no interest in listening to you.
Where's the quote from the Osho out of Enoch?
Yeah, really. Where is the proof that there's something in Enoch, A, that is consistent with the Torah prophets themselves, and B, is prophetic?
And don't use the Jude argument either, because they quote from that, but it was done so much after, and Jude doesn't mean nothing to me, so.
Yeah. And Yeshua means nothing to me, other than may the name be blotted out, and we know Shua means cried out. Yahweh does the saving here. I wanted to bring something up, though, at the start of the show, and it's just something that... you know how we've talked about how halal, the bet was that that Ha Satan said I can get him to worship me even in my own name. And of course he did, Halal and Lord and Baal and all that. You know, I think there was another bet made. And just as Ha Satan was, as they say today, punked in the garden, you know, because he now provided choice, you know, where people would have to choose, which then would become a real relationship. I think that the reason that Yahusha's soul spent that day in Sheol and took the punishment on Pesach, by the way, and Sheol being the worst of the two, from what I can gather, I think the reason is because Ha Satan got punked again. I believe that and this is just my opinion, Yahweh has agreed with him when he said, but there has to be a punishment for sin, for missing the mark, to meet you. And I think at that point, I think that Yahweh said, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
and that's what I think happened there. I think happened.
You know, we know that the book of Enoch's a fraud. We know when it was written and compiled around 200 to 300 BCE, and that it has no evidence whatsoever that it was inspired by Yahweh. There's no prophetic proof in it, and we know, in fact, that it was wrongly attested to a man who had been taken by Yahweh. Almost 2,000 years before the book was attributed to him. But the Book of Jubilees actually claims that it is an addition to the Torah, that it was given at the same time of the Torah is what it claims. And yet it's an apocrypha book. And what does the Torah say? Don't add anything to it.
Don't take away from it.
Don't take away anything from it. Don't add anything to it. But the Book of Jubilees claims to be an addition to it.
Yeah, but his words, you got to understand, Yahweh's words mean nothing to these people. I just showed Mr. Yeshua in here that Yahweh says his name will be, my name will be present on him. He says that in Shemot. And then in Malachi, he also said that too. And then he said in Malachi, he is awesome and astonishing on the account of the presence of my name. Now, we all know that the rabbis love taking Yah out of anything and covering and hiding everything up. So what this guy's doing is running around with the filthy rabbis that Yahweh calls just absolute dirt. And he's following rabbinical teachings with his Yeshua, and I say that with great disdain. And, you know, I just don't think that a scumbag like that should even be in this chat room. He's nothing but a pain in the ass, and he should be thrown out, along with his apocryphal friends that don't believe in Yasha Yahu, where Yahweh says for 400 years, you know, he goes, and I'm going to pick myself. Remember that? He had to pick himself. Nobody would listen to him for 400 years. And so now the book written within that 400-year period of time is the strange book they want to take in here. And, you know, 350-foot giants and so forth. I have to ask, how did these women give birth to these babies that are 350? I mean, did it rip them in half, day two? I mean, what's going on here? I mean, this is just magic.
I just don't know what it is. But if you're any time, and I don't know why so many people do it, but there's people that are absolutely fascinated by, and they will define their whole perspective by the books of Jubilee and the books of Enoch, and you just go, oh my.
And that's all they talk about. Do you know there's nothing instructive in any of those books? That's the thing that slays me.
Oh, they
nothing
they,
about
they,
the Moed.
They establish, yeah, they establish calendars, but they're calendars established by individuals perpetrating a fraud.
Is it
not inspired by Yahweh? Yahweh inspired the Torah. If since neither the Book of Jubilees nor the Book of Enoch was around within 1,000 years of the time that the Torah was written, if the books of Jubilee and Enoch were needed to understand how to celebrate the Mikra as they're described in the
Torah, would have been a problem.
It would have been a real problem. I mean, that would mean that everybody for 1,000 years would have to say, well, we can't do any of this until somebody gives us a book that explains the calendar, and that happened 1,000 years later. And, oh, by the way, the means that Yahweh used to prove, because he said, if you want to know if it's from me or not from me, then here's the test. There's 7 elements of the test. The books of Enoch and Jubilee do not pass the test.
No, they don't. No, they don't.
Just think about this logically, because if the argument they make is that it was actually written by Enoch. So Enoch wrote this book. Abram had it, gave it to Isaac, gave it to Joseph. It got taken down into Egypt. They managed to keep it during the 400 and some years of slavery. They took it with them when they left Egypt. Yeah, and then nobody ever mentioned it. You know, not once did they ever talk about this book, but they kept it with them during this entire
period. Never once did Yahweh say, write this down. Never once does Yahweh give us the scene that where he talks about it. Does Yahweh say that he gave his Torah to Abraham or that he gave his Enoch to Abraham?
His Torah.
His Torah.
Yeah, I don't see Dode writing anything about the book of Enoch there. And how
I see him writing all about the Torah, but I never see him once referencing Enoch or Jubilees.
What is it, just a desire to have a little
The Jubilee argument is the same argument as the oral law that the rabbis make.
Yeah.
You know, they want to have had at the same time. Evidently, according to the book, for those who profess Jubilees, the same thing for those who support the oral law, the Talmud. Their argument is that God's instructions in the Torah could not be understood and that they were not complete, and therefore a second and third set, if you believe Jubilees, of revelation was required, one being the oral Torah and the second being the Jubilees, that both were required because the Torah could not be understood otherwise, that God was an inferior communicator.
Mm-hmm. I don't consider myself really all that smart of a person, but I don't seem to have a whole lot of trouble understanding most of the Torah.
It's funny they would call it Jubilee, too.
I can understand
isn't it?
Much
it's supposed to be Nobel, and they're calling it Jubilee. I find this hilarious. I mean, wouldn't it be the book of the Nobel?
I am where James is. I am where James is. I admit that I am flawed and I have no qualifications. But I don't find this particularly difficult. I find it extraordinarily easy. And I find Dode affirming that. He says the Torah is easy to understand for those who are open-minded. I find it easy. Easy does not mean that it doesn't require time and engagement and observation and thinking. But I don't find the observation difficult. Kirk, is there any part of this that's hard, or does it just take time?
To the translational errors can be a bit difficult. But
I've been able to isolate what is King Jamesian make up for a meaning for something versus the oldest roots words.
Uh-huh.
And it meant this, and that's all it meant. It didn't mean anything else. And then now you got to go and hope to go with the King James. You got to hope that those guys found some secret magical meaning for this word, because it ain't there.
No, and just of course, you know, and the King James was not a new translation. It was a translation of the Geneva Bible, because the Geneva Bible, in its footnotes, said that not only didn't God ordain kings to rule over people outside of Israel, that God was actually opposed to kings and opposed to governments, and they pointed that out. And so that was very difficult to the claims that kings were making that they were ordained by God. And so King James, King Iams, wanted a translation that would not say those things and wouldn't have that in the footnotes, and that's the sole reason for the King James. There wasn't a single Hebrew scholar that was part of the team, and the Leningradis Codex of the of the Masoretic, which is the only even remotely accurate, text
translation
of the Torah, prophets and Psalms, the Leonid Gradus Codex. And it dates to the 11th century. It was not available. It hadn't even been found. It wouldn't be found for 200 years after the King James was written. So there was not even a remotely accurate Hebrew text. There were no Hebrew scholars. And they were primarily Greek scholars. And so they were using things like the Textus Receptus, which isn't even remotely accurate. So you got gibberish. And it became so popular, the gibberish, that because it was authorized, the gibberish by somebody who wasn't authorized by God, and God hates kings, it became so popular that every translation thereafter became a revision.
Mm-hmm.
And none any more accurate.
And the tragedy is the most popular book that ever was published.
Yeah, it is a tragedy.
That's sick.
It is.
Which
sick.
One?
But, you know,
which
King James? The King James version is the biggest seller.
Oh, yeah.
And
it's the most horrible of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And it's the one that makes an attempt to make what Paul wrote sound divine through its Elizabethan English. And
yeah, the Elizabethan English. I love that part. And I see people give me quotes out of that, by the way, when they're debating. Thou shaltest, leaveth the doors openeth. You know, I mean, really, you talk like that?
Really? And you know what I think is also amazing is that today, in Protestant Christianity, the most popular translation is the New Living Translation, and it doesn't even approximate a translation.
No.
You expect to call it a paraphrase would be way too general.
Would you call it a novel?
I call it
I saw you credit a passage to that clown. He had like 24 words, and 23 of them were mistranslated or didn't exist.
Had no basis. There was 23 of the 25 words had no basis in the Greek text.
It was just horrible.
Yeah, that's not a translation. But
you said normally you don't give these guys credit, but in this case, the guy went so far, he really needed to be given the credit. Yeah,
he needed to be given credit. Yeah, make him accountable.
You said he's writing his own Bible over there. Well, yeah, of course.
He is.
But then
his
Bible is
a novel.
Confusion.
Yeah, and you're saying that that this is the inerrant word of God, and yet you're changing 23 of 25 words in a sentence.
Well, God needs help, apparently.
Oh,
it's insane. I mean, I can change the concept of an idea by changing one word in a sentence.
Of course. King James, the first edition of it, was pretty good. You shall commit adultery.
Yeah,
I like that. Yeah, because of course Protestantism is based on that.
The
Great Reformation.
All right. Well, I wish I had read a few lines down with old Wayne, and I'm glad I didn't want to listen to him because his proof texts are from Enoch and Jubilee.
He called me a bastard or something. To be honest with you, I don't think people like that. Can we close people out of the chat room? Because they're not
there.
Three or four of his buddies in there throwing the trash around. And it was very disruptive. I want to get out of my chair and choke one of them. They're ignorant. And we're sitting here working on stuff that is actually instructive to the covenant.
Yeah. Yeah, that was my view today. The reason why I cut him off was that we're talking about the Mikra, of Sukkah. That's what Kirk and I were talking about. We were reading Yahweh's testimony relative to the Mikra of Sukkah, which we're celebrating. And he wanted to call and to say that that's not what it says, when in fact that's what it says, but that he had an entirely different view, and his view is based upon not the Torah, but on Enoch and Jubilees.
Yeah, I know the Torah doesn't matter. This guy's having Sukkah. He's having another month or something.
And having a conniption fit and wants to demean me because I won't let him debate that point.
Well, you just you gave out all the points. He has 27 points he's got to get out of. Now, he put himself in a corner and in a box, and he proved he is not covenant. He's not covenant in the least. He's some guy thumping around with secrets, because these guys all have secrets. Trust me on this. I've debated 100 of them. And they have to have a secret. So Yahweh gave all mankind a chance to look at his Torah so that they could become covenant members, and he hid everything from them. Wow. Thank you, Yahweh.
Yeah.
You're like that Lord.
Is that then, after explaining everything so poorly that you couldn't possibly do any of it, that you then had to turn to a book, the Book of Enoch, that would be compiled around 300 BCE, that for all the time of Abraham, when Yahweh gave him the Torah, and the rest of humanity when he gave the Torah through Moshe to the children of Israel and to us indirectly, 1400 BCE, you couldn't follow any of Yahweh's instructions. That old Hezekiah, when he was trying to figure out the timing of Pesach so that he could celebrate it,
he was clueless because
of the fact that he didn't have the Book of Enoch in Jubilee. They would be around for another 300 years so that he could actually date it.
Yeah. Yeah, and he died. He didn't make the appointments. It's sad.
It's really sad that God has set up everybody to fail, because nobody until the Book of Enoch in 300 BCE could make any one of these appointments, because they wouldn't have the calendar.
Yeah, I know. And I'm
pretty
sorry,
bad, huh? That's a pretty mean
spirit
of God. Oh, by the way, I'm going to tell you, you have to meet with me, or you're going to die, and you're going to be estranged from me. And I'm not going to give
you
the means. Yeah, I'm not going to give you the times that we're meeting until this book that will be extraordinarily thinly distributed. In fact, Jubilee, until they found a few examples in the Dead Seas, the oldest extant copy dates to like the 16th century.
So, you want to know something else that's very telling to me? I'll tell you what people it is that hold this up. It's the Ethiopians. These are religious boobs.
I know.
That run around with crosses all day and claim they've got the Ark of the Covenant down in the basement of some religious building.
And it's accepted by the Ethiopians. That's the endorsement of it.
I know you've got to run, and I know you've got a grandchild to go see, but I just want to give one quote here, and then, Yahweh's Torah is complete and perfectly, complete entirely perfectly, returning and restoring the soul. Yahweh's Eduth, his testimony, is trustworthy and reliable, making understanding and obtaining wisdom simple for the open-minded. Didn't say anything about the Book of Jubilees or Paul or Henoch or any of this stuff. It says straight up, his Torah is complete and entirely perfect for restoring and returning the soul.
Need the Jubilee or Enoch. That's a wrap for today. If you guys are interested, I'll send you the text of this, but I think it's a waste of time.
I'm not going to read six pages of nonsense.
I'll pass.
I went and read that Book of Enoch. I went and read it. First of all, it's really lacking in every way. And what these people are calling prophecy is like, I'm just paraphrasing, but a donkey having giraffes that turn pink and this and that. You know, it sounds like some fanciful,
sounds like something out of the Quran.
They get into monstrous beings and this marriage between spiritual beings and physical beings. The daughters and
can I ask why would a fallen Moloch, since this is what they're saying, can I ask why a fallen Moloch would even want sex? I mean,
for real. Not only that.
Capable of it.
Why would they bother? They're already tearing Yahweh's Torah, a new one, right? I mean, his instructions
right.
to them and everything
right.
else. Why would they marry these women to make it legal?
Yeah.
Isn't this they've taken them and they're marrying them?
Why does a spiritual being have sex with a physical being? How's that even possible?
Why would they marry one?
Right. Why? Yeah. It's just stupid. I mean, the whole concept is ludicrous.
They don't understand that the children of God were the offspring of Adam, who had Nesama.
Yeah.
And they don't understand what the difference between Nesama and Nepesh, and they don't understand that there were people outside the garden for 100,000 years. There is where they lack. I understand what they don't know.
Yeah,
I get it.
A lot of things. But anyway, I'm going to bid you adieu. It's happy Sukkah.
Happy Sukkah.
I'm glad we had the opportunity to listen to what Yahweh had to say about Sukkah. And I do think it's important to reinforce the timing, why Yahweh chose the words that he did, why he chose the times that he did, what these things represent during the year, and the affirmations and the visible symbols that come along with this. It's,
and it's good to know that he did all this before they were in Babylon.
Only by 1,000 years.
Yeah, what's 1,000 years, give or take, when you're in a wild imagination? Oh, I'm so tired of it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it's been great.
Right. Glad to be back. Yeah, thanks for being back. Keep on the man there, JB.
I will.
All right, bye-bye.
Good night.
Bye.